From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, state lawmakers figure out how much to spend patching our roads as we all play dodge the pothole, including important visitors.
These executives who folks are trying to bring into the state to locate their business here, you know, they're bouncing around like lottery balls in the back seat because the roads are so bad and it doesn't send a great impression.
Proposed changes to special education rules in Michigan alarm some parents of special ed students.
It would allow local school districts and ISDs to balance their budgets on the backs of the kids with disabilities.
Plus, Canada wonders why there's no money in the new Obama budget for the second Detroit Bridge.
They're paying essentially 15/16 of this project, and they're not asking for a whole lot from Washington, they feel.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Arguments have ended in the trial over the constitutionality of Michigan's same-sex marriage ban. Today on Stateside, we talk to one county clerk who is ready and willing to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples the moment the federal judge agrees. I'm Cynthia Canty. Also this hour, President Obama has released his budget proposal for the next fiscal year, but it does not include hundreds of millions of dollars for a customs plaza for the new international trade crossing between Detroit and Windsor. What gives?
It's really having customs infrastructure in place is really a Washington responsibility. It shouldn't be something that the Canadian government should also have to pitch in and cover the cost for.
And then we find out about the concerns that some parents have over proposed changes to Michigan's special education rules. But first, Governor Rick Snyder says Benton Harbor's financial emergency is over. It has been 4 years since the state appointed an emergency manager to run the city's finances. Snyder attributes Benton Harbor's success in part to the new emergency manager law he signed after voters repealed a former version. This law gives managers broad powers to fix the finances of cities and school districts. The governor also gives Benton Harbor's most recent emergency manager credit for building trust in the community.
So it would be a combination of, you know, the right person at the right time with the right abilities and relationships being built, working well with people within the city to say, let's get this wrapped up.
Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter Lindsay Smith joins us now. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Cindy.
So how was this conclusion made that a state-appointed emergency management should end?
Well, it comes down to the single most important factor is the budget. When Benton Harbor first was taken over by the state, the budget deficit, the annual sort of running your checkbook month-to-month budget was like $3.5 million deficit. So now that has been resolved. They have an operating surplus of about $1 million. Now that is thanks in big part to a loan from the state. But basically they've been able to pay down all their debt, their old debts, restructure their old debts. They've been able to make contributions to their city's pension fund for the first time in like 10 years, I want to say. So those are sort of the main factors that brought this conclusion.
And they've really made big cuts in their city staffing, haven't they?
Yeah, the city staff has gone down by about roughly half. I mean, this is a smaller city of about 10,000 people. In 2010, when they got taken over, they had roughly 120 full-time employees. Now that's down to about 60, a bit more than 60. They've consolidated their police and fire departments. That was under the previous emergency manager, Joe Harris, had done that a couple of years ago. And that really brought the biggest cost savings, I would say, to the month operating budget.
So now emergency manager Tony Saunders is handing down his last order and the governor has appointed a transition team. How does this work?
It works like this. The governor appoints this receivership transition advisory board, as its technical term. He's appointed four people to serve on this board, and it's supposed to help provide a smooth transition. I mean, they've been under state control. City Commission has had pretty much no powers for the past 4 years. So it's supposed to help guide them through the next, you know, few years at most. I mean, the thing about the team is there's not really a defined period that they serve. The four of them will serve at the pleasure of the governor, and it's expected that they will tell the governor when they're not needed anymore. The makeup is the Berrien County Treasurer. So that's the county where Benton Harbor is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a state audit manager within the Treasury Department, and then there's two former Whirlpool managers on this team. Whirlpool is the biggest appliance maker in the world, and it's headquartered in Benton Harbor, so they'll have some local experience.
So what do you think other financially struggling cities should watch for and maybe learn from what's been happening in Benton Harbor for solutions to their own troubles?
Well, Benton Harbor was sort of a unique guinea pig, I'd call it, because when it was taken over, Governor Granholm, former Governor Jennifer Granholm, was in office. We were operating under a different emergency manager law. They've operated the city under three different emergency manager laws, so it's been a bit more of a trudge, I would say, to get through the trenches in Benton Harbor through this stuff than perhaps it would be for a new municipality or school district going through the same process. However, I mean, yeah, I think that there is some things that you could learn from them. I think combining services, streamlining services, they had a lot of training for city officials and city staff. They had a lot of turnover, city manager's office before, and other high-level city staffers. High turnover rate it's kind of an indicator. It seems to be an indicator for financial problems. So hopefully some of that training will help them, and I would guess that other cities would find that helpful too.
So when you think about what we should be watching for from Benton Harbor in the coming few months, I'm guessing no news is good news.
I would, too. I would note, though, that there is sort of an ongoing thing in the background here that's kind of important to this now that local leaders are taking back over. There's always a history of recalls in Benton Harbor. People get elected, and then immediately it seems like there's always these recall efforts to get rid of city officials, even when they didn't have power. And there's currently, right now, there's a recall election for the mayor. So there will be a mayoral election in May. It will be interesting to see if the current mayor stays or if they'll boot him out and go with another sitting city commissioner who has some different ideas for the city. So I do think that that may play a role besides just the general no news is good news, which is definitely the case for Benton Harbor.
Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter Lindsay Smith keeping an eye on Benton Harbor for us. Thank you so much, Lindsay.
Oh, glad to be here.
A challenge to Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage is coming to an end in federal court in Detroit. Arguments have ended, and we're now waiting for a ruling from federal Judge Bernard Friedman that is expected within the next 2 weeks. The case involves a lesbian couple from Oakland County and their adopted children. The women want legal joint custody of each other's children for purposes of inheritance, benefits, and guardianship should one of the parents die. But state law doesn't allow gay marriage because Michigan passed that constitutional amendment in 2004 that bans same-sex marriage. Oakland County Clerk Lisa Brown wants to issue marriage licenses to gay couples, and she joins us now. Welcome to Stateside, Lisa.
Thank you.
If Judge Friedman hands down a ruling that says Michigan's ban is unconstitutional, how quickly would you begin to issue marriage licenses?
Assuming that there is no stay, immediately. We're ready to go here. So we're just waiting for the word.
And what have you done when you say you're ready to go? What has that entailed?
Well, I drafted, along with the help of the state registrar's office, a gender-neutral marriage license and affidavit to marry. I'm waiting for final approval for those. I think he's waiting for the judge to make his decision before he gives that. But besides that, we're just ready to go. I can also officiate at marriages, so you know, my staff is well aware of the situation, and they just know that when we get a hearing, hopefully in support of the plaintiffs, that you know, things will be a little different here, but better.
So we've already heard from the state attorney general's office, and they're saying they're going to appeal if the judge rules the ban unconstitutional. You say there could be some kind of an immediate stay. It's hard to know how quickly that could happen. So if you're planning to marry as many as you can, many same-sex couples as you can, will this confuse things, legally speaking?
You know, again, it all depends on whether there's a stay. And obviously, I won't be able to do anything if the judge grants a stay. But I think that people have been denied their equal protection of their rights for so long in this state that I think if there's the window where, and I think ultimately, you know, it's going to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court will shut it down? I mean, why do they have to? Why do people have to wait any longer to get equal protection of the law?
What would happen for the couples that, let's say there is a window before a state? We have to play what if.
Mm-hmm.
So my partner and I come in immediately and you marry us. Then comes a stay that says, hold off, hit the hold button. Legally, where would I stand with my partner if we did indeed get married?
I believe your marriage would still stand because that would be what the law is right then and there.
Okay.
A stay wouldn't change what the law is, right? It's just saying, well, we're going to wait to enforce what the repercussions are until there's a decision by a higher court.
All right. We will watch for this. I know we've got that couple of weeks waiting, and then I'm suspecting that if Judge Friedman hands down that ruling that overturns it, you're going to be a busy person.
I hope so. I know that I've heard from a number of people who have told me they're going to be first in line. So obviously not everyone could be first in line, but we know that there are people who are just waiting to be able to enjoy, the fundamental right of being married.
Lisa Brown is the Oakland County Clerk. Lisa, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Proposed changes to special education rules in our state are causing alarm for some parents of special ed students. Marcy Lipset is the founder of the Michigan Alliance for Special Education. It's a grassroots organization advocating for special ed students. Marcy, you say these proposed rule revisions would be devastating. Why so?
Actually, I will go beyond that. I will say catastrophic, simply because the Michigan Department of Ed is looking to align our state rules with the federal. Whenever you hear the word align with state and federal, you are reducing your state-imposed rules. Those are the rules that exceed the federal. So the MDE is looking, and what they have proposed would virtually eliminate our state-imposed rules that exceed, and it would allow local school districts and ISDs to balance their budgets on the backs of the kids with disabilities.
Are you opposed to all of the changes or some of them? And the reason I say that is I'm looking at, a six-page list of proposed changes. So there's a lot here in this summary of the Michigan Administrative Rules. Are you opposed to all of this wholesale, or is there just some areas that really concern you?
I am proposed to all of them because I think the Michigan Department of Ed has pretty purposely and willfully muddied up the language. But the key revisions that I am opposed to is removing what we know is a multidisciplinary team. That is supposed to be the team of experts that evaluate a child for eligibility in one of 13 areas. The Michigan Department of Ed is proposing to bring that down to the federal language that simply requires a person who is knowledgeable to interpret. So in reality, what this will allow school districts to do is to reduce the number of individuals evaluating a child for a disability. It will reduce the number required to attend an individualized education program team meeting. And this is all about time and money. So I am against removing the multidisciplinary evaluation team. I am against giving local school districts complete control to determine special education staffing annually based on the number of students. The state of Illinois.
Well, let me ask you that. Let me ask you about that, because I see this particular change that would let either intermediate school districts or local school districts or academies figure out their staffing needs. Is that not preferable to some blanket requirement from Lansing when you get a sense that every district has its own budget concerns and staffing concerns?
It is anything but preferable, because the Michigan rules guide and govern the number of children on special education teacher caseloads and related service providers like speech and language. That has been problematic enough because of a rule back in 2002 that gave our intermediate districts permission to override all those rules and create what we know as these alternate special ed plans. So since 2002, the size of special education programs, the size of teacher caseload, has literally been a free-for-all across ISDs. Now, if you add local control to this, you will absolutely see districts balance their budgets on the backs of the kids. They did this in 2009 with the federal stimulus dollars when they received millions in special ed funding. And they used federal stimulus dollars to reduce their special ed budgets. So giving local control, we will see disparity, we will see inequity, and even in what we call our more affluent districts, we will see larger and larger special education teacher caseloads, related service provider caseloads, speech and language, occupational therapists, physical therapists, and we will see even poorer outcomes for the children.
Let's talk about the idea of balancing the budget and the staffing and spending concerns, because even in the more affluent districts, districts all over Michigan are hurting. There's less money and they're struggling to make ends meet. Well, I'm talking in broad terms there, but I think we're all in agreement of that. So why should special education be exempt from having to tighten up and balance the budget and spend less?
Actually, special ed has not been exempt. Special ed has taken a great hit. The fact that school districts used a one-time influx of millions of dollars of federal stimulus money specific to special education and used that money, and in many of our affluent districts, to reduce their local budgets by as high as $6.4 million in Detroit. I mean, districts all over the state used federal stimulus to reduce their budgets. So kids with disabilities have taken a big hit. To codify these changes into rules that are not revised very often would absolutely devastate conditions for the kids and devastate to a degree that for the first time, leading national advocacy organizations are jumping in and chiming in on Michigan and sending out action alerts.
I want to just touch on, with pages and pages, we clearly can't go through each of the rules. But as I look at, for example, a couple of them, one rule that adds a specialist position for students who are deaf, hard of hearing, or hearing impaired. Another rule adds a specialist position for students with visual impairments. That's a problem?
Well, it's a problem because they're lack of the training. We have a critical shortage of hearing impairment and visually impaired teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So what the MDE is doing through these revisions, both by adding a specialist and then making changes to the actual teaching endorsements for hearing impaired, visually impaired teachers, they are lowering the standards to try to fill a void. And frankly, I appreciate we have a shortage. We have a shortage for not a lot of good reasons, and we need to address why that shortage is. But lowering the bar for those teachers means that the students will not receive the quality of instruction they need to make progress in grade-level curriculum and earn a meaningful diploma.
We have put up a link on the stateside page at michiganradio.org to the state's proposed changes and also to the details on the public hearings and the public comment period. Again, that's on the stateside link at michiganradio.org. And we've been talking with Marcy Lipsett. Marcy's the founder of the Michigan Alliance for Special Education. Marcy, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
And we did put in a request to speak with someone at the Michigan Department of Education about these revisions, but the department told us they had no one to comment at this time. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
We've all got stories.
Some are very extraordinary stories. It might be good for somebody to look into theirs.
Because a story is the shortest distance between two people.
The Living Room is our ongoing storytelling series curated by Allison Downey. The next story is the first in our series about identity and acceptance in West Michigan's LGBT community.
Rachel Gleason spent much of her youth at her church. Worshiping, studying, singing, babysitting, the church was her life. But that began to change when Rachel started to understand who she really was.
My name is Rachel Gleason. I'm 27. I grew up in Hudsonville, which is not too far from Grand Rapids. We definitely, you know, weren't allowed to watch a lot of stuff on TV. My mom would be like, that's raunchy. Everything was raunchy. Like, you know, we weren't allowed to watch Friends when I was a little bit older. And so, of course, I, like, loved that show.
Okay, you have to stop the Q-tip when there's resistance.
From my dad's front yard, you can see five churches. The church that I grew up in, they always kind of talked bad about, like, those churches that they were, like, dead and quiet and, like, they weren't moving in the spirit the way that we believed you were supposed to. You know, it was a very small church. There's probably 60 to 70 people any given Sunday. It was a branch off of Pentecostal. I learned there that being gay was like the worst thing you could be. Just by like the language, the way that they talked about gay people, seeing news clips of like the gay pride march at Grand Valley and like, you know, my mom like making a disgusted noise and changing the channel and like just seeing those people. And I remember seeing those like butch women and being like, oh, like that is the worst thing you could be. Like that is the worst. And I don't know if I, you know, even knew that was like internalized homophobia, but there was definitely always preaching against that. By the time I was in high school, I was going to church five nights a week. Yeah, because we had Wednesday night services, Thursday night prayer meetings, every single Friday night, except maybe one. Saturday, they would have intercessory prayer. And then Sunday morning, we had worship service at like 11 a.m. I was on the church puppet team, which was special all on its own. We knew we were weird. We knew that other churches didn't act the way we did, didn't fall down and cry and roll around and march around the sanctuary. We almost wore it as like a badge of honor, like we were on fire, that we had it. We had something that they didn't have. A deeper connection with God. And that kind of was proof. You know, when you did doubt, you're like, well, you feel this, don't you? And like they called it the presence of God, that feeling that you would get when 60, 70, 80 people are in the same room with terrible acoustics and everyone's just like yelling and singing and crying and speaking in tongues, and all this energy is focused on the same thing, and it's this energy that's like palpable, and like people really did fall down. Like I believe that some people literally have been knocked off their feet by that feeling, and that was validation that God was good and that God was moving and that God was alive in the world and that he could do things through you. And it was very empowering, and a lot of those moments were really beautiful and I loved them. They felt really good. Being slain in the spirit is what it's called when you fall out. And they'd have ushers like ready to catch you. They'd start praying for you. And if you wouldn't fall down, it's like they'd call in reinforcements. And so there's all these people just like, like intense, like praying for you. And so it's like sometimes I would like, you know, just fall down right away to avoid that. Like the longer they pray, the more they'll see of me. Like I was always hiding something, like so afraid that they would see the sin in me. And I think just in general, I felt like I was always not good enough and hiding. I don't know how consciously aware I was that I was gay, but I think that was probably part of it, that feeling of hiding something, maybe not knowing exactly what it was, but that was a big part of it. My senior year, I felt really hard for one of my friends, and that was like the first time I like realized that, you know, I couldn't deny those feelings. I had had similar feelings, but didn't know what they were. I don't know why I felt jealous when my best friend liked a guy. I didn't understand, you know, didn't know. So I got books, some gay literature. I think one of them was just The Color Purple, Fried Green Tomatoes. Like hid them in my room on the side of my bed and like the cabinets and stuff. And I came home one day and they were sitting on the like buffet cabinet in the living room, and I was just like, oh my God, like this is it. And my mom was in her room like reading one of them, and like I came down the hallway and she came out of the room and she was like holding it and she confronted me. I remember just crying and kind of just sitting, and we were sitting in the living room together, and at the end of the conversation when it had been quiet for a while, she said, so what do you want to do about this? And the implication was asking whether I would go to counseling or not. And I agreed to go to counseling to pray the gay away, quote unquote. The pastors, they told me that I was no longer going to be a greeter, that I couldn't, you know, because that was one of like our duties, but people would take turns like standing by the door and opening the door and greeting people when they came in. I was going to be no longer in AWIPS, the Awesome Warriors in Prayer group, until I had been healed, as they said. I remember being really scared that everyone was going to find out and wonder why I wasn't doing any of those things anymore. I remember being hurt and feeling guilty, and that it was like kind of relieved that it was out in the open. But mostly I remember feeling humiliated and leaving the office and getting yelled at because I was late for puppet practice, and my friends like asking where I was and what the meeting was about and why I was crying, and I remember that decision of, okay, I can either stay here, stay in the church, don't tell anyone, never get married, live this life, be on fire for God, or walk away from it into something that I had no idea what I would do or where I would be or what my life would be. But like the possibility of like finding love was like important to me. When I was 18, I was living with my mom, going to Grand Valley, going to counseling. But my writing 150 professor was my first college writing class. So I started to try and write a paper about homosexuality and evolution and all this. And she was like, let me talk to you after class and like see what you're thinking. And it kind of just ended up being this coming out paper. It was called My Closet Has a Window. And it was the very end of the paper. You know, I said, I know what I have to do. I've always known what I have to do. I just haven't found the courage to do it. And I turned that paper in, and then I went on Christmas break and decided that I was going to come out and that I wasn't going to go to the church anymore. But I met with each of my church friends. I told my friend Hannah just one-on-one, and, you know, she couldn't believe that I chose sin over her and that friendship and my faith. But I haven't talked to her or really, really seen her since then. And, you know, leaving the church meant I didn't have any of those friends. I literally had one friend to my name, and it was an acquaintance from high school who was gay, and another friend that I had just met that I barely knew were, like, my only friends. Because everyone else, even my high school friends that didn't go to church with me, were not okay with me being out. I think I felt really guilty, just heartbroken, the loss of those people and hurting those people, and that knowing that I would always understand the way that they felt because I'd been there and I'd been in that position, and knowing that they would never understand why I did what I did or, you know, respect it. You know, I still have love for them. I think they're misguided, and I think their hearts are in the right place, though. It's harder for me to forgive the pastors. But yeah, I'm very happy and very at peace with where I am, and so glad to have the freedom that I do. And sometimes I'll have like nightmares that I'm back at the church and I have to like break away all over again and like tear myself apart all over again. And it's like terrifying to feel that, to be back there and feel that pressure again of like I have to hide everything. And I wake up and remember that I don't have to do anything. I don't have to answer to anyone but myself. And that's exactly where I want to be.
Welcome back to Stateside. As we all gingerly pick our way through Michigan's pothole-ridden and crumbling roads, state lawmakers are now hashing out just how much money to spend on fixing the state's roads and highways. Chris Gouts is Capitol correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So here we have our lawmakers trying to figure out how best to use that windfall of more than $1 billion in surplus revenue. And we're hearing them say, well, we're going to use about, $100 million or so of that for a supplemental funding bill for our roads?
Yeah, that's about the long and short of it. That's all they're really talking about. Now, the House has asked or has requested to put in another $115 million, but that's tied up in another issue. And from most accounts, it doesn't seem likely that money will end up being used. So most observers believe that what the Senate put on the table, which was $100 million out of the general fund from this reserve amount, is going to be at the end of the day what gets approved.
And what are we getting a sense as far as how that money will be used? What are they going to use it for?
Well, if you listen to lawmakers, you know, they're going back to their districts and they're putting out press releases saying how they're, you know, going to be putting this money to fix the potholes. You know, everybody's, you know, just complaining, like you said in the opening, about, you know, just the potholes are ridiculous and you're having to sort of slalom through these ridiculous streets. It's also in terms of, you know, economic development. You know, when we bring people into the state, you know, and we pick them up at the airport and when we drive them around, they have, you know, these executives who folks are trying to bring into the state to locate their business here. You know, they're bouncing around like lottery balls in the back seat because the roads are so bad and it doesn't send a great impression. So, you know, what they say they're trying to do is they're trying to put this money to fix things right now. But actually, this money what we're talking about, this $100 million, mm-hmm. isn't going to go towards anything this winter. This is really summer money, and it's not really being portrayed that way, and it really should be. This is because MDOT and the counties and the local groups, they're going to fix the pond strongholds right now with the money that they have. But what the money they have is money that they had previously budgeted to do summer repair work. And so this, because of the harsh winter that we've had, they've already blown through that money, and they're spending their money on their summer budgets right now. So this money is just going to simply backfill what they were going to do. So if they don't get this money, that means that you're not going to see, you know, grass mowed along the highway medians. You're not going to see, you know, chip and seal work done on the highways, which, you know, prevents potholes from appearing next winter. So there's all sorts of things that are going to be done with this money, but it's not going to happen this winter.
And it certainly seems, reminds me of my mother's old saying about borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. So that's what we're seeing with this pothole repair. So borrowing from the summer budgets. You were saying some counties have even totally blown their yearly budget.
Yeah, when I talked with the head of the County Road Association of Michigan, she said, you know, about 80% of the counties are in the same boat as MDOT. And, you know, they're going to have to put all of this money that they would get out of this $100 million to put into their summer maintenance budget. And because some operate on different fiscal years, they've already blown through their entire annual maintenance budget. And so if this money doesn't come, they're not going to have any money come this summer or this fall, if they're on a calendar year, fiscal year, to do any more work the rest of the year.
And don't let any of us, it sounds like, get any hopes up that windfall, this budget windfall, and that $100 million will result in real improvements, right? We're just going to be hopefully just treading water.
Oh, no, absolutely. The $100 million is simply, you know, a patchwork, you know, to get some of the pothole repairs done. You know, even the $1.3 billion annually that the Governor Snyder is requesting, that's not to build any new roads. That's simply just to maintain the road system that we have now, to keep them at fair, you know, or good status. You know, we've got so many that are slipping into poor status. And so, you know, the annual money is just to keep them, you know, at basic sort of, you know, functioning levels that aren't, you know, just completely decrepit, and to raise up some of the ones from poor status, you know, back to, you know, to good or fair conditions. So, yeah, this is just a small pot of money.
And we saw how far he got with that $1.3 billion request, which is now well over a year old.
Almost 2 years old.
Almost 2 years old. You're right. Could it be that we, meaning taxpayers, are we getting tuned up for some kind of long-range fix for roads? Like, you know, folks, if we're going to do this, we need a new tax on whatever.
It's possible. You know, the governor made this big push, you know, for the last year or so, and it didn't really go anywhere because, you know, folks, you know, the roads were bad, but they weren't anything like they were, like they are right now.
Yeah.
And so he might have the, you know, sort of the general mood of the public on their side, but by the time they would get to a solution, you know, for this, we're talking after the state budget is approved, you know, in late spring, early summer. And so by then, you know, the snow and the ice is going to have melted away. Most of the biggest pot, you know, the big potholes or the craters in some cases will have been repaired. And so where then is the public mood going to be? You know, people are upset about the roads, but until the polling suggests that they're equally willing to pay for fixing the roads, you know, to their level of, you know, frustration with the roads, I don't think you're going to see any big changes happening.
What should we be watching for then, besides the big potholes as we drive along and we don't want to wind up with a blown rim or a blown tire?
Well, I think you're going to see a continued push from the governor to try to, you know, make the case. Although, you know, he didn't put this in his budget like he did, you know, the previous year, and he's not going around the state sort of barnstorming, doing town halls in Republican districts and in other areas trying to give cover for, you know, for this type of a vote. He's not doing that. You know, maybe he will, but right now we're not seeing it. So I think if you want to see that really big push, you know, maybe that's something that you could look for. But right now it doesn't seem to be happening. It's mostly just happening behind the scenes, but this is an election year, and you know, people have their, you know, lawmakers have their concerns elsewhere right now, and it's on them, and which is a little harsh, but it's also, you know, what they're hearing from their constituents, and so until they hear, you know, that the level of outrage is there the way it was in '97, I don't know that you're going to see a big package be approved.
Chris Gouts, capital correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business. As always, a pleasure to talk with you, Chris. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Obama recently submitted his budget proposal for fiscal year 2014-2015, and you could almost hear the sighs of exasperation on both sides of the Detroit River. That's because missing from the nearly $4 trillion budget was the $250 million needed to get construction going on the new bridge across the Detroit River, specifically money for the U.S. Customs Plaza for the new International Trade Crossing Bridge to Windsor. Now, Canada is footing most of the cost of building this bridge, so that missing $250 mil is the only piece of the project that the U.S. would kick in, and it wasn't in the Obama budget. Joining us is Windsor Star reporter Dave Battagello. Good to have you with us, Dave.
Glad to be here.
So we've already heard Governor Rick Snyder serving up some sentiments that for him are actually downright testy when he told the Detroit Free Press, and here was his quote, "I wouldn't want to see the rest of the bridge held up over what you might describe as a somewhat difficult to understand attitude." That's very big from our relentlessly positive governor. What's the view from Canada?
Well, we kind of support the governor's position. Canada feels like the Canadian government, that is, feels like they've come to the plate quite sufficiently on this project. As our Council General in Detroit, Roy Norton, has pointed out, they're paying essentially 15/16 of this project, and they're not asking for a whole lot from Washington, they feel. And it's really having customs infrastructure in place is really a Washington responsibility. It shouldn't be something that the Canadian government should also have to pitch in and cover the cost for.
Yeah, and as you say, with Canada ponying up something almost all 15/16 of the cost of a bridge, which everyone, I think, except Ambassador Bridge owner Maddie Maroon seems to agree is very much needed. But so even without that $250 million for the Federal Customs Plaza in the Obama budget, is Canada still forging ahead?
Yeah, they've got a lot of work to do on this project, and they're not going to slow down because this issue, among many, is still unresolved. They're hoping that as work gets going on this, and when I say work, I'm talking about property acquisition, there has to be utility relocation, there has to be some demolition of existing structures, homes, businesses, some site clearing to make preparations for this project. So they're going to get going on all that, and I hope this issue gets resolved in the meantime.
Now, Canada's transportation minister is scheduled to go to Washington March 25th and should be meeting with Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox. What do you think could come out of that meeting?
Well, it's not the first time they've got together, but they're hoping that this time, just the timing of it is crucial in advancing this issue on the Customs Plaza. The two will likely have some type of discussion about it. It's not going to be new to Mr. Fox. This is something that I'm sure he's already well aware of. And what's going to have to happen is Congress is going to have to get more informed on this, because any further action on this in terms of getting the money has to come from a political level in Congress.
Because we do know from looking at the Obama budget, there's about $482 million, give or take a few, of new what's called infrastructure money. So is that the hope, that they can slice out $250 million of that for this new plaza?
Yeah, that's a pretty, in my opinion only, it's a pretty far-fetched hope, because that's not an awful lot of money. And you have the Mexican border, you have several other border crossings between U.S. and Canada. So that money will disappear in a hurry, because all these border crossings are busy. All of them need infrastructure money to keep expanding to do what they do. To see $250 million, essentially half of that money, just come to Detroit for this project is a pretty big chunk of that sum. So the hope is really to get more funds added to that $480 million by Congress so that this project can, in effect, get going.
So it does seem like Michigan's congressional representatives kind of have their job cut out for them. And we've got Senator Levin leaving by the end of this year. So there's a lot to do in terms of working the back halls on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, there's quite a bit to do. And you also have John Dingell leaving as well.
True.
And his name was on a letter that was sent to the president just last week. So you have a couple key people, longtime members of Washington, leaving at a pretty difficult time just in terms of this project.
Now, just from what you're hearing from any of the officials in Canada, could this second bridge still be derailed, or is it going to happen?
Well, you talk to anybody within the Canadian government, they're pretty confident. We have a feeder road here. That's a $1.4 billion project, and it was a very similar process where there were hundreds of homes in the way, many businesses, hotels, restaurants, all in the way of this feeder road that needs to go towards this new bridge. And within days, within weeks, all of a sudden you started seeing properties bought up. You started seeing them demolished and knocked out of the way. And the provincial government and the federal government here, once they made up their mind, this thing started to move very, very quickly. So the hope is on this side that the same thing will now happen in Detroit. Once the money starts to flow, people get on the ground, you'll see properties start to be purchased very quickly, site clearings start to happen, and then people will see the reality that this bridge is going to go.
And on target for that 2020 opening?
Yeah, that's what the hope is. I don't know if that's realistic, but that still seems to be the hope. Because in the background, you still have Mr. Maroon from the Ambassador Bridge, who is also going to do what he can legally to kind of derail this process.
That is Windsor Star reporter Dave Battagello. Now, over the weekend, Ambassador Bridge owner Maddie Maroon asked a judge to stop the U.S. Coast Guard from giving a permit for the new bridge. Maroon's attorneys say the company has an exclusive right to provide a bridge between the U.S. and Canada, and a hearing on this latest motion is expected in early April. A college class that involves a lot of poring over ancient biblical texts might not inspire a whole lot of excitement. But a college class that teaches some of the very same lessons using zombies? Well, sure, that's the idea behind a religion class at Central Michigan University. It's called From Revelation to the Walking Dead. Joining us is a student from the class, Carl Huber. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, how does talking about zombies eating your brain lead you in the class to deeper discussions about what you would do, say, in the event of a cataclysmic event or an apocalypse?
It's very interesting. We talk about that a lot in our class, of especially at the beginning, like, what would you do? What would be your weapon and things like that? Mm-hmm. But looking at the text, especially a contemporary text, we're like really examining like what the fear is behind zombies. Like, why is zombies this generation's monster of choice rather than vampires of like the last generation?
Very true.
And it's not a really simple answer. There's a lot of different facets to it. But one of the main things that we come across is that zombies play more of a minor role in some of the more popular like movies or TV shows like The Walking Dead.
Sure.
You have like the zombies that play a part of a threat, but the more bigger threat is the surviving humans and how threatening they are, the governors, if you've seen more of the recent seasons of it, that really attack like the survivor group and the moral ambiguity of who's good, who's bad, what is good and bad. Can we shoot zombies? Is that morally right to do that? And if it is, why?
Give us a sense, as you have these moral discussions, just the way we did in school when we were reading Lord of the Flies, and now you are, as for example, you dissect the movies of The Walking Dead. What kinds of conversations come up and questions come up about morals in your class?
All sorts. Looking at the survivors themselves in particular, it's really hard to determine who's a good guy and who's a bad guy. And there's a lot of tough choices, killing people that are people, not zombies, for the greater good of the cause. And is it okay to do that? Or really just, it's not even just about killing, but what about stealing, loitering, you know, going in and taking food or water from places that you would normally pay for, but in a world like this, is it okay to steal it?
And how do you think that kind of conversation will inform maybe life choices or decisions or positions that you and your classmates might wind up taking?
I think it reflects a lot on like certain events that can actually happen. I mean, you look at Katrina in New Orleans. When that happened, there's a lot of moral ambiguity, like people stealing things for just to survive or breaking into certain places just as a survival thing. And I think that anybody like could be put in that situation in the right, you know, in the right context. The right perfect storm happens and you're thrown in that context, you're going to literally have to think about that in relation to yourself, and it's going to be in a very important issue.
How do you think our ideas about the apocalypse have changed over history?
Oh, vastly. I mean, we study ancient apocalyptic literature, especially with like the Bible, and a lot of that has to do, within context of like what was going on at the time, more of a symbol of hope. Like all this bad thing will happen, but God will come in and help clear it up.
Make it all right in the end.
Right. And then you look at today's with like the zombies apocalypse today, and a lot of it is just it's just utter destruction and just complete annihilation. And then you have certain survivor groups that provide a little bit of hope, but it's nothing like what it was in the ancient biblical text.
Why do you think there's less hope today?
I don't know. I mean, in the recent years, in the last century, you've had a lot of like wars and a lot of things that just numb people. Violence on TV, and people are just a little bit numb to it. And I think that's why like zombies are so grotesque, where vampires are a little bit more clean-shaven, a little bit more prestigious. But zombies are so grotesque and so lawless. And I think that really hits to the core of people. It cuts through all that that numbness to violence and everything, and it really hits them at the heart.
So it sounds like, yes, this is a legit religion class. Yes, we're learning, and yes, we're being challenged.
Yes, absolutely. It's a challenging course, but in the best way possible.
Carl Huber is a student taking a religion course at Central Michigan University called From Revelation to the Walking Dead, learning lessons through zombies. Carl, it's been great talking to you.
No, thank you very much. It's been great talking to you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hedelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tenniskatter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.